Hello and welcome to CJ Evolution, the podcast dedicated to helping criminal justice professionals like you. Now here's your host, fellow CJ Evolutionary, Patrick Fitzgibbons.
Hello everybody, welcome back. Episode 179 of CJ Evolution, that's Criminal Justice Evolution. Pat Fitzgibbons here. Whatever you were doing, wherever you were at, thank you for spending a little bit of your valuable time with me. I sure do appreciate it. We continue to grow because of you, the listener, and I sure do appreciate your support. Whenever you get a chance, you can head over to iTunes and rate and review my podcast. I sure would appreciate it. You can find it. You can find a link on cjevolution.com. That's the new website. It's still, well, actually, it's not new. We just went from a .net to a .com, so that's pretty exciting, right? Everybody wants to be a .com. Well, maybe so much. Not anymore, but if you head over there, rate and review my podcast on iTunes, I sure would appreciate it. Very excited to have Christian Cipollini on. He's an award-winning journalist, writer, organized crime historian, designer, collector of rare crime-related photographs and artifacts, and it was a great conversation with Christian. And again, it shows you the motivation behind very successful people and what keeps them going. Again, I encourage everybody, if you're teetering on whether or not to do something, maybe write a book or launch that project, do so. And Christian's going to give you some tips if you are an aspiring writer out there. I know we've heard some of these before, but he gives some new tips out there to go after your dreams and keep plugging along, even when the naysayers are trying to bring you down. So enjoy this great episode with Christian Cipollini. Hello, everybody. Welcome back. Very excited to have Christian Cipollini on the show right now. He's a journalist, writer, organized crime historian, designer, and that's just the beginning of what this guy does. I mean, he's an amazing author, amazing writer, and I'm so honored to have him on. Christian, you there, sir?
Oh, Patrick, thank you for having me.
Well, man, I reached out to you, I think, a couple weeks ago, and yeah, I'm just fascinating with what you're doing. With, you know, you're an organized crime historian, you know, you're a true crime author. I want to talk about that, and I'm just glad you're here, and because I think it's fascinating that you're writing about organized crime, and I want to talk about that. But what got you into writing? What was the catalyst? I mean, did you always want to write, or was it something specific?
There really was an epiphany, if you will, in fourth grade. Mm-hmm. I pretty much by fourth grade realized I sucked at everything I tried to do, whether it be sports or science, you name it, and I was not good. But a writing assignment that I did completely incorrectly, and I'll never forget, my teacher came up to my desk and he said, "You did this entirely wrong. It is really, really good, though." And he went on to just explain to me what I did do. And it was at that moment I realized, wow, maybe I am good at something. Even if I don't follow instructions, I'm really good at something. So, yeah, literally, that's what started the writing.
And did you have people – I imagine you had, you know, people throughout your life – encouraging you and saying, you know, you need to follow through with this, because you don't become successful like you do, Christian, unless you have the right people around you, right?
Wow, that's a really good point. And I probably should give props to my family and even my childhood friends who I don't know. I always say I'm my own biggest cheerleader and my own harshest critic. Yep. And I forget that there were a lot of people who, when I thought I was doing something dorky, like, you know, writing little comics with little, you know, storylines, yet these kids in the neighborhood thought it was cool, and I didn't understand why, you know. So, yeah, I guess you really bring up a good point. I have to think about that. There are a lot of people I should probably thank today.
Yeah. Go ahead.
My parents were always supportive of whatever I did, you know. I don't know if they thought I'd ever amount to anything with it, but you know, they were sweet. They were sweet to me about it.
That's cool. And you write, obviously, when did you become — you write a lot about organized crime. When did you become interested in organized crime? I mean,
you know, that was a lot of pieces falling into place that I didn't even realize at the time. I think the fire was sparked when I was a kid, having a dad who — my father was a narcotics cop. I had a friend whose estranged father, you could say, was from the other side of the law. So growing up, I kind of had I call the best of both worlds influence. I just didn't realize. Mm-hmm. Like I always thought I'd be like a fiction writer or maybe go into the movies behind the scenes, something like that. But as I got older, I started to consume biographies and books like that because Dad loved that stuff. So it was a lot of my father that got it. And it was years later after freelance journalism in every field, entertainment, local news, you name it. And then I was like, oh, wait, I love that crime stuff from like when I was probably 19, 20 is when it really bit me.
What crime figure? I mean, there's a lot of history, you know, I'm speaking of the crime, you know, organized crime, mafia. Who is your favorite, you know, crime figure, you know, that you've researched and really was fascinated by? And then maybe there's maybe more than one, but who are the most fascinating subjects you've researched and written about?
I'd have to say this is sort of a twofold. It was late 80s, early 90s. Me and a friend were in a local library, and they had copies of the New York Times there. Mm-hmm. And we keep seeing – and as a police officer, I'm sure you already know who I'm going for with this. You see this cocky, well-dressed guy on the front page every day, and we were just fascinated. Who is this guy?
That's got to be Gotti. Like,
yep. And that's what I think – I got to give credit to it. That's what sparked me back or really to jump into the crime, because it's something I think Patrick's always fascinated me is the human element. It's like, mm-hmm. what makes people tick? I couldn't put my finger on it then, but me and my couple close friends were like so magnetically drawn to this. Like, who is this guy? Mm-hmm. How does he run New York? What is this? And that's what did it. But the other one, once I started understanding more of the bigger picture as I got a little older, a little more mature, was Lucky Luciano. Mm-hmm. Charles Lucky Luciano, to the short answer to your question, is the one some people say I'm obsessed with. It's not what it is. But that's the one I really am drawn to.
Now, why were you drawn to him? Was it just his life, or the, what do you mean? What was, I mean, I know it was the organized crime aspect of it because that's what you like. But what specifically drew you to Lucky? Because there was plenty of gangsters over the years.
Sure. And
Al Capone,
the big ones, right? And Lucky wasn't even. I don't even think he was a household name quite to the level Capone is. But just to preface it, I was at a charity book fair when I was maybe 21, 22, and it was a quarter per inch a book for this charity, and I found this copy of The Last Testament of Lucky Luciano. I read it. It was entertaining. Then I started reading like real books on the economics and the politics, and I realized a few years later, oh, wait, people think that book was crap. Like it was made up, and it crushed my world because I thought it was like the most entertaining, insightful memoir, and mm-hmm. you find out it's not true. And years, you know, jump a few decades, and I'm like, well, I'm going to get the story straight. And I should say it's not because I'm trying to glamorize or glorify. Mm-hmm. It's more like history keeps repeating itself, but it's repeating the wrong information. And these people were a part of society, and it kind of needs told. And Lucky, I guess for lack of a better – I don't know, Patrick. When I read The Last Testament, I was like, wow, this guy wasn't just one guy. It was an ensemble cast.
Yeah.
That's what made – it was like everybody in the mob was interlaced with him. So I think that's the very short answer. I'm sorry, I'm all over the place.
No. And I do think too. I mean, I do think it's fascinating to look back at that time period, you know, in the 20s and 30s and maybe, you know, the 40s. And I mean, you're the expert on this, Christian, but it would have been a fascinating time. Look, I'm not trying to glorify the violence or the murder that was going on. But it must have been just an amazing time to live. And I think we're in an amazing time now, but to see those Capone and, you know, Elliot Ness and all those. I mean, just the good guys and bad guys, and it's just that time in history. You know, it must have been fascinating.
It is, and I feel like I'm living that, and what I'm trying to do is get that out, because there is that living vicariously element to it. It's like reading a fictional story that takes you away, except, whoa, this was real. Yeah, like this really happened. There were G-men and gangsters, and you know what? There was a really murky area between the good and bad. Not everything was so cut and dry. Not that today is any different in some cases, as we found, but which again comes to the relevancy part. I think there's still things we haven't fixed, you know. But anyway, that's probably another.
Now, when you see one of my favorite shows about Al Capone, and there's a lot of movies, is The Untouchables with Kevin Costner and Al Pacino, or not Al Pacino, but De Niro, Robert De Niro, who played Al Capone. Now, and I'm sure you've seen that movie, and you are the expert in this. Do you think that that is an accurate description of what it was like back in the 30s during the times of Prohibition and Chicago, and you know, we could talk about other things like the Valentine's Day Massacre. Do you think that that was a good description of how it was like, you know, back in the day?
I like the way you phrase that. Because I get to temper myself, and as a purist, as a historian, I just tell everybody, look, of course, as a historian, I get really particular about biopics because, generally speaking, they're crap. It's Hollywood creative license, and not that I haven't taken some in my comic book where you have to. But here's the thing. With movies like that and shows like Boardwalk Empire, there have been some amazing visual, stunning cinematography, amazing actors, movies like American Gangster, The Untouchables. These were all great, and I'm going to say this, movies. Movies. Accuracy of that one in particular, and I know somebody's probably going to get mad, but
– No.
It's laughable at what they did and the introduction of some of the characters and how they had them behave. That movie is visually stunning and entertaining when you look at it from a historical standpoint. I mean, not even as a historian. It was Hollywood, I don't think, has mashed – oh, no. There is one movie that was worse, Mobsters with Christian Slater.
Oh, Christian Slater. That was a horrible movie. That came out in the 90s or something like that?
Yeah, it was like 90, 91 it came out. That was even more historically nauseating to historians. Again, not to sound like some pretentious, you know, whatever. I used to love those until
I started learning about it.
Yeah.
Researching.
And I'm like, here's my argument with Hollywood, Patrick. And you know this from your career. Truth is stranger than fiction. You really don't have to jazz it up. There's some crazy stuff out there that is A, entertaining, B, unbelievable, but it's true. And I think Hollywood seems to miss that point. I think it's like fiction. Well, here, add this dialogue. That'll make it better. Add this character. You don't have to.
Yeah.
Not with what we've dealt with in life. That's just – again, that's my rant. I'm off my soapbox now.
Now, I know you're fascinated with Lucky, but if you had a chance to meet him and ask him a couple questions, one question, what would you ask Lucky Luciano?
All right. I do have a few I would ask, but if I – the top question I would ask is I know he answered this once, but I would ask him. I'd be like, was it the police that really beat your ass and left you scarred? That's my main one I'd want to ask him. And then I would ask him about his tattoos, which a lot of people don't know he has, and he tried hiding them. I would ask him to show me the naked girl tattoo on his left arm that he hid from everyone. I would. It's just the way
– I wonder why he hid – I mean, you probably know, but why do you think he hid that? Was it just taboo to have – you know, I don't think it was that – I mean, because you had people in the Navy and stuff that were, you know, I mean, military who had
one
tattoos.
One of his actually resembled a typical Navy a tattoo, actually, and he was never in the military. No, he had – he had actually said in the 1950s when he was giving interviews more commonly, he would tell if he was asked, like, oh, you have tattoos. Yeah, I got them when I was like 17. And, you know, he's being a rebel and they were faded. But the one on his left arm was literally a topless girl, and it had a banner that said, you know, true love forever. And he just he said, I just cover them. I don't like them. And I know if you look at all the photographs where he's wearing a short sleeve shirt from the time he was arrested in 1936, you can see he literally makes a point of covering his arms anytime he sees a photograph. Probably what you said, part of it taboo, part of it that what he said, he just didn't like them. He got them when he was a kid. But yeah, I would literally say to him, please. And I've seen photographs of the other tattoos. I'd ask him, Lucky, please let me see the other tattoo.
So. Now, did he have kids? And I don't know, Christian. I mean, did he have kids? I don't know.
No, people have come out of the woodwork over the years, but here's the facts of the matter. Mm-hmm. He had what I believe one true love. He was a ladies' man, definitely a womanizer. And they apparently liked him. He loved the showgirls and vice versa. But later in life, he had his one true love. He was once asked in an interview in Italy during exile, are you married? And he said, no. I always knew I would end up in prison or with a bullet in my head because of my lifestyle. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want a wife or kids to deal with that. Mm-hmm. And she corroborated later and said, no, we're not married, you know, but she was his one true love. Mm-hmm. Then she died of breast cancer, and he was never the same again.
Yeah. Did not know that. Now, some people might not know this, and maybe some do. You know, you're a successful author, but you're also known for your collection of rare images from organized crime history. What was the first picture or artifact that started you off with your collection?
I got my inspiration from a book I read. Actually, I consider him my mentor. Arthur Nash wrote a book called New York City Gangland, and it was mostly photographs of artifacts and photographs that he has in his collection. Like, he's a big-time collector. So I get his book. We end up becoming chummy. He explaining to me and teaching me about this. So jump ahead. Right before I wrote my first book, I went on an auction site, and for $8, I bought a press photo of this really mean-looking black guy from 1975. I mean, he had eyes that looked like he just killed someone. Mm-hmm. I buy the photo, flip it over on the back, read the press notes, and find out, oh, yeah, he was a professional hitman for the mob in Detroit.
Wow.
There you go. Hence my first book, based on an $8 photograph I got at an auction. So that
wow.
Yeah, that's my nerdy collection thing. I collect pretty much anything from 20s, 30s, 40s, and a little bit of the 1970s. Press photos, police, crime scene photos, mugshots, the original stuff. Wanted posters. Yeah, that's my thing.
Now, where can people go to find these, Christian?
Well, there are – if you go on the internet and Google auction sites, there's always somebody getting rid of an estate and they find this stuff, or, you know, their great-grandpa was a cop, you know, say in Buffalo or Chicago, and give it up. And then eBay, you know, sometimes somebody will find things. And other collectors, they like to trade. It's not that hard. It's – what's hard is finding that ultra rare gem and then finding out 10 of your colleagues are also bidding on it. That's when it gets vicious, because you know it's your friends or colleagues that are bidding. Yeah, it turns vicious. But yeah, it's available, and what's really, really cool about them is that it's like holding history.
Yeah.
And well, as you know, as an officer, the information beyond the photograph, that's what fascinates. What you flip it over and see the notes.
Yeah.
That's what gets me. That gets me up in the morning.
Now, talk about the books you have out there, Christian. How many books do you have? What are their titles? Where can people find them?
Well, I have three out there right now. My first one was Diary of a Motor City Hitman. That was about Chester Wheeler Campbell, Detroit hitman, worked for the drug underworld for both the urban faction and the Italian mafia. Mm-hmm. Then I did a book on Lucky Luciano. It's called Mysterious Tales of a Gangland Legend. In tandem with that, shortly thereafter, I wrote another – it was part of a mystery series for my publisher. I did Murder Incorporated, which, again, goes kind of hand-in-hand with the Lucky book. And most recently, it's the comic book series based on Luciano, which I kind of used to fill in some blanks and vice versa, book to comic book. So you kind of have, like – I don't know. It's like the whole package.
Yeah.
And Amazon, Barnes & Noble.
So where what advice would you give? I know you've probably got this question before. You're a successful author. There's many people. And I believe there's so many people out there, you know, especially cops, that have one good story in them, one good book. Mm-hmm. You know, and I know personally I have friends that are in law enforcement that you know, always talk about, you know, being, you know, writing a book or doing something or publishing something. What advice would you give to aspiring authors out there, Christian? Because I imagine you had to go through some trials and tribulations before you had the success you did. What advice would you give to some aspiring authors out there?
Well, absolutely. First of all, it's like any field. You don't just wake up one day and boom, you know, this is it. You're great. It's successful. Mm-hmm. It's not. You really do go through a lot. But I think I just like to add, for all the hype and the media and marketing that you do, it's the moments where, say, a school asks me to sit with some aspiring journalism students and things like that, where I get to give the good, the bad, the ugly, all of that. It's almost like paying it forward. That's the moments that really make it worth it. So I do love trying to help anyone else maybe avoid some of the crap that I've seen and had to deal with. But you're going to. What it is, first of all, have the passion to do it. I hate to make it sound like – have zero expectations except that you're going to do your best and be happy with whatever that is, because you're setting yourself up if you think it's going to happen overnight or whatever. Mm-hmm. Just – don't, and good things will happen, especially if you do have a great story. But you really have to have the fire. I think that's within any vocation. If you don't have a true fire to do it, don't do it.
Mm-hmm.
Find your fire. And if you want to be a writer, I don't care if it's fiction or nonfiction, it's rough. But when you love it, it's what gets you up every damn day.
Yeah.
So and you know what? Listen to your peers. It's not a lonely solitude. It is lonely in solitude, but you really need to network. And you can't sit in grandma's basement and type away and think you're good. Yeah, I have to use that analogy because there really are people who think that. You can't. You have to network and help other authors, and that's how we do it. I think that's why all of us are successful.
And is it easier, a little bit easier now, Christian? I mean, again, speaking to the choir, I mean, you know, but I've heard authors that I've had on the show, many of them, saying it's a little bit easier now. You can self-publish and things like that than in years past. What's your opinion on that?
Since I am part of this a newer wave, if you will. You know, I didn't really start into this until we were way past the era, like that, say, somebody like Stephen King had to deal with to try to get articles published, a book published. There's a good side. You don't have to go to a traditional publisher. If you do, there's definitely upsides to it, be it small publisher or big. There's also downsides. You're not going to see as much of the back in the day where you would get lots and lots of money up front if they really loved your idea. It's not so much today.
Yeah.
There's not if you self-publish, that's great because you have total creative control for the most part, except you may not have the distribution that you would elsewhere. So it's a lot to take in, and some people feel overwhelmed, and believe me, there are days I do too. I want to bang my head off a wall, but that's part of it. It is ultimately, though, to answer your question, yes, it's much easier to network, to make contacts than typing letter after letter and finding addresses to mail to a publisher like, you know, say 20, 30 years ago. So yeah, it's definitely easier if you want to do it. And hey, ultimately, you can do it right from your computer and publish it yourself.
Well, I think the key is, and you hit on it, Christian, is that you know, nothing happens overnight.
No.
You know, success doesn't happen overnight. I mean, you have to work for it. If you really want it, it will come. Case in point, you're a very successful author. It didn't happen overnight, you know, and be prepared. You know, I know with my podcast, sometimes they get, you know, oh my God, that's a horrible show. And why'd you, you know, why, you're horrible. Why are you doing this? But you got to get back on that horse, man. You got to get back up and keep going. And I know, again, I'm speaking to the choir, man, that you just got to get up and you're going to get critics out there and you just got to go after it.
No, you bring up a really good point, and it's not preaching to the choir, because all of us, as you know this, we have to remind ourselves or be reminded by our friends and peers, hey, don't throw in the towel just because somebody gave you this terrible review, or that article you wrote didn't get picked up.
Exactly.
Or, you know, the next one might. And you know what? Ultimately, I look at life this way now. As I've gotten older, I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up, and that's okay.
I love it. There's nothing wrong with that. It keeps you young. It keeps you innovative. It keeps you creative.
It does, and I think, like I said, I think love what you do. I mean, just love what you do.
Well, Christian Cipollini, sir, if anybody wants to reach out to you, where can they find you?
Oh, I'm all over social media. It's a necessary evil, and I kind of do like it. My handle on most everything from Twitter to Instagram is Gangland Legend. My website is ganglandlegends.com. If anyone – I'm pretty approachable, so if anyone has any questions or wants to reach out, go ahead. And, of course, my books, you can find at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. My comic book series is through Stash Publishing and Grind Studios. My colleague Seth Ferranti runs that. So, take a look. Any questions, comments, we welcome it.
Any exciting projects you're working on for the future or what?
I guess I can leak a little bit of this. For the last 2 years, Seth Ferranti and I and another team have been working on a super secret documentary film that is kind of my epic baby that I've been studying. I was actually going to do a book years ago. I'll say this. It's going to uncover and dispel some myths about the origins of the war on drugs, which actually began in the Roaring Twenties. And we're almost ready. We're almost ready to put out some teasers.
I'm thinking about the minute you said that. I'm thinking like Reefer Madness. Remember that? Remember that?
Things that came, especially in the 50s, all started thanks to a guy named Arnold Rothstein in the 1920s, and a lot of the famous gang stars that we've so romanticized, Capone, Luciano, Legs Diamond, they were all part of this little entourage. So I think it's time. I think this should be good. I hope it is.
Well, I'm sure it will, Christian. Sir, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on the show. We wish you much success in the future. I'd love to have you back on
in the future. Thank you.
It was truly an honor. And we wish you the most success in the future. And take care, my friend.
Thank you so much. I hope to do it again soon.
All right. Thank you, Christian.
Thanks for listening to CJ Evolution. Be sure to head over to iTunes and rate and review the podcast, and reach out to Patrick on Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Anchor, or Snapchat. We'll see you next time on CJ Evolution.